Welcome to Unjustly Maligned, the show for people who go against the grain. We seek to rehabilitate overlooked, ignored, derided, and just plain hated contributions to pop culture. Movies. I'll say that again. Movies, novels, music, comic books, video games, whatever. If everyone hates it, we'll find someone who loves it and let them explain why you should too. I'm your host, Anthony Johnston, and my guest today is an award-winning author whose debut fantasy novel, The Golem and the Genie, was nominated for both a Nebula and World Fantasy Award and won the 2014 Mythopoeic Award for Best Adult Fantasy. She's working on the infamous difficult second novel right now, but not exactly right now because first she's got a podcast to record. She is, of course, Ms. Helene Wecker. Helene, welcome to the show.
Hi, Anthony. Thank you so much for having me.
Why don't you tell us what you've chosen for this show to talk about and then give us some context around its release, its reception upon release, why people malign it, and why you think they're wrong to do so?
Well, what I have chosen is the 2005 film Constantine, which is based on a comic book called Hellblazer that used to be done by Vertigo, which is an imprint of DC Comics. And when it came out, when Constantine came out, it was immediately panned and immediately just sort of attained, it seemed like overnight attained the status of, well, yeah, that movie was bad, but at least it wasn't Constantine. And I've been confused about this for years. I don't know when I first saw the Constantine. I was in grad school in 2005. I wasn't seeing that many movies in the theater, so I can only assume that we rented it on DVD, and at some point I saw it, I was like, this is an okay film. This is, you know, this does not belong in the Criterion collection. But why does everyone hate this film as much as they do? And from sort of general context, I knew that there were two groups of haters who hated on Constantine. The first group, who I have a lot more sympathy with, are the people who have been reading Hellblazer since, you know, it first started in, I think it was 88, or, you know, people who came on later. I believe that the character of John Constantine actually started back in 85, and he's created by Alan Moore as part of Swamp Thing.
That's correct, yeah.
But then he got his own comic in 88, and it stopped, I want to say, was it 2003 I read that they finally closed the door on Hellblazer, and he became part of New 52, and he's got his own comic under sort of like the more general DC umbrella now. Okay, so the character of John Constantine, as he is in Hellblazer, as I'm sure a lot, or if not most of your audience knows, iconic British character. He was created to look like Sting. He is sort of a bleached blonde. He's this skinny twig of a man. He's in like the rumpled raincoat, and he smokes silk-cut cigarettes from dawn till dusk. And he's this sort of down and out, a little seamy, sort of living on the ragged edge. And I have to admit, and I'm sure this is when most of your listeners are just going to howl and curse me, I was not a regular reader of Hellblazer. This was like back in high school, I fell in love and read Sandman. Fell in love with Sandman, read the whole thing. And Sandman, you know, which was sort of the other, you know, obviously Neil Gaiman, you know, now legendary, iconic comic book. It was the other flagship book for Vertigo, I think, sort of from the beginning of Vertigo. And they were sort of universe adjacent, the two of them. And I know there's at least one time when John Constantine showed up in Sandman, in one of the early issues. And I think he might have showed up somewhere later, too, or was referenced. I don't know if any of the characters from Sandman ever crossed over into Hellblazer. But I also had one of my best friends in high school. Her name was Sally. She was a regular reader of Hellblazer. So every once in a while, I'd go over to her house, and I would, you know, page through a few issues and you know, sort of get, you know, just that sort of dipping your toe in every once in a while just to see what's going on. But I was never like really fully invested in the characters, in the sort of the timeline, all of the mythology that had sort of been built up around the character and his world of, you know, defending Liverpool and the greater UK from the forces of darkness. So I think maybe in that sense, I was sort of the perfect audience for this movie. When Hollywood took the character of John Constantine and, as Hollywood is wont to do, sort of lifted him entirely from his larger sort of milieu or whatever, and reformatted him for Hollywood, for an American first audience, and all of that. Because, and I the reason I say that is I knew enough about the character and the premise to sort of fill in the back, you know, the places where they sort of elided or just plain forgot to fill you in on what exactly is going on. But I wasn't so invested that I was completely incensed about the things that they'd either changed or gotten wrong or, you know, whatever. I know that there were many, many readers for whom, you know, Hellblazer, you know, John Constantine, not in Britain, is just not John Constantine anymore. This is like, you know, Superman, you know, defending truth, justice, and you know, the Belgian way or something. It's just not, you know, this just isn't it anymore. So that I totally understand. I mean, I was a huge X-Men reader when I was in high school and early college, and then, you know, the X-Men movies came out and did various things with various characters. You know, the rant that I gave my husband after X-Men Last Stand, I think, is one of, you know.
But did you like X-Men 2?
Okay, X-Men 2. I did. And, okay, so my X-Man was Nightcrawler. So, it, going back to that sort of idea of you know, what have they changed the character beyond recognition or what or not, they retained enough of Nightcrawler that I could see him, but so much of it they sort of changed into this sort of moody loner Catholic, you know, haunted, you know, sort of
strangely self-loathing character.
Strangely, yeah. Self-loathing, weirdly tattooed for some reason. character that part of him just was not. This was the whole point of Nightcrawler, was that, yeah, he looked to most of humanity like a monster. He was an outcast, and he's an awesome guy who's usually pretty cheerful and has a fabulous outlook on life and is incredibly friendly. And, I mean, the sword fighting and the palling around with Wolverine and playing jokes on people. And, you know, that was who he was. You know, his hero was Errol Flynn, that sort of a little campy, a little swashbuckly, you know, but also with that deep reserve of spirituality that, you know, sort of, you know, despite everything, allowed him to really carry on in a wonderful manner. And so that had, you know, sort of angered me that they turned his character in some ways. But, and I know we're getting totally off topic.
No, but I think this is a really interesting parallel, actually. I quite liked X-Men 2, by the way. I thought it was the best of the three X-Men movies.
It was really good. It was a very good movie. It was a very good movie.
But here's the interesting thing. What they got wrong with Nightcrawler was that they made him look very much like the comic Nightcrawler, but they got his personality completely wrong.
Yeah.
Whereas with Constantine, I feel that it doesn't really look like Hellblazer at all, and God knows Keanu does not look like Sting.
Mm-hmm.
But the character and the attitude of the character, I think they got absolutely right.
And okay, you, I have to ask you a question, because when I proposed to you that I come on and do Constantine, it was the second thing I thought of when I heard that you were doing this podcast. The first one was the Doctor Who TV movie, and I saw someone got there before I did.
Beat you to it.
So immediately Constantine was like the very close runner-up. But you said that you had never seen the movie.
And that's correct.
Afterwards, I was like, oh, goodness, he's in comics. This is, you know, I'm sure he must have had some I'm not seeing it sort of thing. Was that why you hadn't seen it? Was
no,
it you
not
just
at
didn't
all.
Want to? Okay.
Okay. So I had never seen the movie before. I watched it just last week. I watched it with no real preconceived notions. I, funnily enough, like you, was only ever a casual Hellblazer reader.
Uh-huh.
I was much more into Sandman, like you.
Oh, funny.
So, like you, I knew the background of the character. My partner, Marcia, is actually a big Hellblazer fan. She loves John Constantine. But so, you know, all these things, I know who the character is. I know his background. I have friends who've written him, you know, I know a lot about the character, but I've never been a voracious reader of the books. So like you, I didn't have a sort of, I wasn't offended by some of the changes they made.
Right.
And I didn't really care. I don't really care with movies about how faithful they are, because all adaptations have to change from the source material. I've gone on at length about this in the show before, and I'm sure I will again. I've written adaptations myself, and you have to change things.
Mm-hmm.
You cannot make a slavish, you know, like word for word, image for image recreation in another medium, because then it fails in its new medium.
Mm-hmm.
But I had heard that this was, now, and I like Keanu as well, by the way. I will defend Keanu and his acting skills, you know, to my last breath. But I had heard that this is a pretty bad movie.
Uh-huh.
Simply that. Like, you know, people, pretty much everyone I knew who had seen it, and every review I'd read had said, this is a bad movie. So that's why I hadn't seen it. It wasn't a sort of comic purist thing by any means. It was just, I've heard it's pretty bad. I'm not going to watch it.
Right.
And they were wrong.
Okay. Wow. Okay. Hooray. There's at least two of us.
Yeah. I agree with you entirely. It's not going to make it into the Criterion Collection, but it is a good movie.
Yeah.
It is actually, I think, more faithful to Hellblazer than a lot of people realize. No, it looks completely different. Yes, they've relocated the character, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But the essence of Hellblazer is very much in this movie, I feel.
I got that too, that feeling of the very gothic Catholicism where the other worlds are, you know, within arm's reach and we never know, and there's the everyone has the shadows that follow them that you know that we just don't know about sort of stuff that really seemed to be sort of the meat of Hellblazer. Really do feel replicated in this movie. And I mean, and I say that out of, you know, what, you know, two steps above total ignorance. So I'm sure there's all sorts of people who would want to argue with me. But like you said about adaptation, you know, I've had people ask me, you know, oh, so if they ever do like a movie or TV show of your book, you know, which, you know, that and, you know, and When Pigs Fly and whatever, but would you want to write the screenplay? And I'm like, I am the last person in the world who should write the screenplay for the, you know, theoretical movie or TV screen, because everything feels essential to me because I was so deep into it. And, you know, maybe in 10 years from now, I'd be able to look at it and say, okay, here's what we can elide and here's what we can, you know, sort of sum up or twist into someone else or have someone else looking at that perspective that would be able to, you know, make it a 2-minute, you know, introduction into something instead of the 15 minutes that it would be, you know, if you did it as it was sort of, true to how it is in the book or whatever, you know, the different mediums call for very different ways of doing things. And that's why, especially for something that isn't a TV series where you don't have, you know, an episode just to lay the groundwork, you know, and set the stakes. You got to do that straight up from the beginning. And that's why they have that John can see the truth of, you know, people, see if they're angels, you know, influenced by the angels or the demons, or if they're the half-breeds or whatever, which I you know, he can't do in the comic book. He's more just sort of like, you know, he sees the world as it is, but he just knows about all this other stuff. That's just to get the audience to be able to, you know, be there with Constantine and see everything for as it is.
It's shorthand, yeah.
It is, exactly, it's shorthand. And so stuff like the fact that he committed suicide at age 15 because he could see all of this stuff. And there's a line that I absolutely love where Angie says to him, you tried to kill himself. And he says, I didn't try anything. And that he did kill himself, and that is why he is now damned, is because if you commit suicide, you've destroyed the soul, the life that God gave you, and so your soul is sent to hell. And so he knows that that's where he's going. And okay, so I take it that the sort of the bones of this plot was lifted from a storyline that Garth Ennis wrote.
Very, very loosely.
Yeah, very, very loosely. Back in the early 90s, I guess, and that it's sort of the same idea that he is dying and he knows he's going to go to hell, but it's because of backstory. You know, it's because of large backstory having to do with like a botched exorcism and a few other things and whatever. And so it's him trying to finagle his way out of going to hell when he dies. And I think, as far as setting up the stakes in a very quick manner, they did a very, I didn't look up who did the screenplay. I really should have. Not that I would have like really known. I'm not familiar.
It was two gentlemen called Kevin Brodbin and Frank A. Capello, neither of whom I confess I've heard of.
Yeah, I mean, good on them for, you know, figuring out how to, you know, to do this in a quick manner that nevertheless feels like, oh yeah, I would want to try to get out of that. You know, that's, this is a man who is facing his last days knowing that he's due up for eternal torment. And that, I mean, talk about high stakes from the beginning of the movie. So that was a really good, you know, way to sort of turn that up.
Yeah, screenwriting is a really compressed art. I mean, we say that in comics. In comics, we have to compress a lot. And brevity, you know, is very much the art of the form. Uh-huh. But I think in screenplays, that's even more the case because you have so little time, especially these days, uh-huh. You know, with modern audiences, you have so little time to establish your world and your characters and what's at stake and why the audience should give a damn. And yeah, I think this movie did a pretty good job of doing exactly that. As you say, making changes to the character, certainly. The whole suicide at 15, I don't believe has ever been in the comic. But it serves, and again, being able to sort of him being able to see who's influenced by the angels and demons and stuff, it just serves as visual shorthand to get the audience on board and go, oh, okay, I understand what this character is about, what sort of man he is and what sort of position and dilemma he's in. It may not be exactly the same one as the comic book, but like I said, I think the essence is still very much the same, still there.
Yeah, yeah. Definitely.
It's funny that you mentioned about length as well with adaptations. There's a lovely story in many years ago, Brian Bendis, before he became a big superstar at Marvel, wrote and illustrated a short comic series called Fortune and Glory about his adventures in Hollywood with his independent books like Torso and Jinx. Mm-hmm. And one of the stories he tells in there is that I can't remember which one, but he was invited to write the screenplay adaptation for one of his books. And so he was absolutely ruthless and he burned through it in a couple of weeks and he was cutting stuff out left, right and center. And there was nothing left. And he was like, yeah, I've done a real screenwriter's job. And then he handed it in. It was like 220 pages or something. And his agent was like, yeah, it's a little long.
Cut it in half.
Right, because as you said, he didn't have that perspective.
Yeah.
He was too close to his own work at the time. And that is a real danger for anybody adapting their own work, which is why I think, because, you know, if Jamie Delano or Garth Ennis or even Alan Moore or anyone would have tried to write a screenplay like this, you would never get a screenplay like this. You would never get the changes that they've made because they don't have the distance from the material. And I think that that's actually necessary to make a good adaptation.
And I would love to write screenplays or comic books sometime. I have a problem with brevity myself, and I think, as anyone who's read my stuff probably figured out. And I feel like that would be really, really good training for me. But Lord, not
of your own work.
Not of my own work. That would be no. So should we get on to the meat of the movie?
Let's. First thing I want to say is, man, Keanu is just eternally young, isn't he?
He's a frightening man.
He was 41 when this movie was made, and he looks 30. It's insane.
Well, and not only that, he's standing next to Shia LaBeouf, who is 19.
Right.
In this, and he's they look like maybe there's 6 years, 7 years between them, but no, he's
good genes, man. He's got good genes,
and he looks like he weighs about 72 pounds too. I mean, he is skinny. He's like David Tennant is looking at him and saying, "Dude, eat a couple sandwiches. This is ridiculous." Now I'm interested in your comments earlier about Keanu and that how you will defend him to the death, because I think that he is, if there is a weak link in this movie, it's Keanu's performance. But
oh really?
Yeah. Yeah. Okay, so here's my thing on Keanu Reeves. I love watching him. He's got the body language down. He looks completely like he has just sunk into this movie and into the role. As soon as he opens his mouth, for me, it just sort of falls apart. I don't know what it is about his performances that it's like he learned English on a different planet where everyone speaks a little more slowly and puts emphasis in strange places, and the line reads, there's something about the line readings that just lift me out of the movie, because everything else just the director has taken such care to line up these shots, and some gorgeous visuals in this movie, and he's standing there in the skinny suit with just black and white, and he's got and then there's Rachel Weisz, who's also usually in black and white, and the two they just look, this thing is just polished, and then he opens his mouth and it's like,
and you think the devil is responsible, people are evil, Mr. Constantine, people,
you're right, we're born capable of terrible things, but then sometimes something else comes along and gives us just the right nudge.
Well, this has been real educational, but I don't believe in the devil.
You should. He believes in you.
That was the line reading that you... That's what we ended up with. That's the one that made it into the movie. And I don't know what it is. It just feels like he never gets out of himself. And this isn't just this movie. It's in a lot of movies and that he does. And the... I know it's like low-hanging fruit to bust down Keanu or whatever, but I think the reason that he worked so well in Matrix, at least in the first movie, I saw the second two in the trilogy once and never again, but at least in the first movie, is because he is supposed to be sort of this everyman. He's supposed to be... maybe not quite a cipher, but certainly you are supposed to be able to imprint yourself on him. And, everything is coming at him so fast, and he is the audience surrogate in the movie. And so it's almost like to his benefit that there's a certain blandness to him at the core. But in this movie, he's the one with the knowledge. He's the one who's having these conversations that are filling in the audience.
And he's weary.
And he's very weary. But weary doesn't mean drugged. And that's I feel like there's weary, but there's also, wry, and wryness, which is part of the weariness, I think, of the character, requires a certain fatalistic energy to it that I just don't get from Keanu's performance. And I'm not going to trash on it anymore because that's not what I am here to do. I am here to defend the movie from its many detractors. But I also know that, you know, it's not like the detractions were coming completely out of a void. There were things about this movie, I think, that could have been improved.
Oh,
definitely,
sure.
Definitely. But and for me, Keanu's performance is one of them. But every time he's just the first shots in the movie when the beginning of the movie is a bit scrambled, and I think they did not do themselves any favors with these sort of rapid cuts back and forth between Mexico and LA and you know, suddenly there's, okay, is that two versions of the same character played by Rachel Weisz, or is she a twin, or why is she dreaming now? What is she doing? Why did she wake? You know, and only later you realize that was her twin sister, and that she jumped off a roof and all of that. And so the beginning takes a bit to sort out, and so I feel like that probably left a number of people sort of wrong footed in terms of like, okay, so what just happened? But there's the first actual shot you see of Keanu Reeves' face is when he's coming to perform the exorcism, and he's walking down this long hallway, and he's smoking one of his cigarettes, and he's got this squint on his face, and he looks, like you said, like he's tired, but also sort of gearing up. It's like he's walking to work. He's walking in to a job that he hates on Monday morning, but he's also got a sort of... But he also can't be weak about it because, this is a job that you hate that can kill you. So there's just this squint in his eyes that looks perfect. It's just gorgeous. And it's one of these long shots. The movie does a lot of these sort of long symmetric shots where he's in the middle. And I think it's, I'm sure that the director is saying, there's so much talk about balance in this movie, and that, and there's this idea of John being sort of like in the middle of the balance, and he's the one who, deports the half-breeds when they break the rules, when they destroy the balance. And so that you get all of these, he's sort of the dividing line in the screen. And it's just great. And, and it was funny because I was watching the movie last night, and we're going through that beginning sort of slightly incoherent first 5 minutes of the movie or so. And I'm thinking, why do I like this movie? I mean, it's sort of like, I was like trying to get into it again, and oh man, am I just going to be sitting there talking about everything that I, don't like and trying to remember? And then it got to that shot, and I was like, yes, okay, that is why I like this movie, is because of, it's not just the characters, it's not just the story, it's how much love and work the director put into those shots like that really set a gorgeous mood. And yeah, some of this is not the first movie that has done sort of the dark spiritual, horror noir. No, this is not new ground that this movie is breaking. I mean, I'm sure it's ground that the comic book itself helped to break over the last, 30 years.
Mm-hmm.
But, it got dinged for not being original. It's like, well, how much out there these days actually is original? And B, okay, there are, and have been since then, so many of these sort of good versus evil, the last stand of the world, the forces of darkness, blah, blah, blah. There was, did you ever see Legion with Paul Bettany?
Oh, no, I didn't know.
Oh, it's sort of like he's like the Archangel Michael, and he's defending humanity from God's wrath in a diner in the middle of nowhere, which is a great concept. In practice, it was just this, morose shoot-'em-up with angels and demons.
See, I'd heard that's what this movie was.
Yeah!
This is one of the things that this is a note I made. I had heard that this was a brainless, gun-toting demon hunter thing, because you had that promo picture of him with the crucifix gun, which went all over the internet. Everybody was outraged about that.
Yeah.
But that gun doesn't even appear until over an hour into the movie.
Yeah.
And it is not the sort of brainless action movie with demons that I had been led to believe I was going to watch. And I was glad of that, you know?
Yeah. And there's like one scene where he's using that gun to shoot a bunch of demons, and it lasts, what, like 45 seconds maybe?
Yeah.
And I, when I got to it last night, when I was watching it, I was like, oh yeah, this is that scene that like for many people was like, for some reason, this is what they took as, no, this is what this movie, the whole movie was about, when it really wasn't. I mean, most of the action sequences in the movie take place like while people are basically doing seances, which is pretty awesome. I'm glad that I'm getting like sort of angry about it now, because it means that, no, I really do feel, I really do like this movie.
It really is unjustly maligned.
It is.
Keanu, I got that sense of fatalism that you mentioned from him. I did. You're right. He wasn't an energetic performance, but I took that as being that kind of weariness, mm-hmm. and yeah, that fatalism. And as you say, a man who is, he hates his job, but he knows that he's got to do it. And for him, the stakes really are, you know, the ultimate stakes.
Yeah.
And one of the other things I liked about this movie was that even though the stakes, you know, the scope of it is, oh, end of the world, you know, second coming of the Antichrist and all that, the actual scale of it is really small. When you think about where everything takes place,
yeah,
there aren't many characters in it. There aren't that many locations in it. It's a really small scale movie, but done in a really clever way so that it doesn't feel claustrophobic. I thought that was really, considering it was Francis Lawrence's debut feature, I thought that was really clever, really good filmmaking.
It has that neighborhood feel to it, in that, you know, this is LA, but this is not, you don't get the sense of like the scope of LA. It you know, it's LA mostly because it all looks in that sort of like baked and slightly washed out sense. And it's mostly like bodegas and like a bowling alley that for some, I want someone to explain the bowling alley to me, because it's, and I really should get the DVD with the director's commentary. I'm sure that I would learn all sorts of interesting stuff. Just even, you know, just cruising around on the internet, I was learning like everything about, there was like a whole subplot that got cut involving, Constantine's like sort of on and off girlfriend, who's actually a succubus, who has like,
oh, wow.
her entire role ended up on the cutting room floor, except for one line. She's in there. She has one line. It's Michelle Monaghan, and it's in the last showdown scene at the hospital when the sprinklers come on with the blessed water, and she looks up and she says,
"Holy water."
As her face starts to melt off. That's
her.
Is
that
her?
She
had like 15 minutes in the movie, and it all ended up on the floor. So that they did in order to make him more alone, I think, was the reason to sort of increase his solitude, his ostracism from the distance from the rest of the characters.
And also to just trim it, because one of the other things I liked about this movie was that there is very little fat.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it doesn't waste your time. Every scene is important to progressing the story and the characters of the movie. You know, it's a very well-crafted movie. I've said this before about certain films. You know, it's not a work of genius, but there is a very good level of craft going on in almost all aspects of this movie that I think people too easily overlook and take for granted. Whereas if you know a little about, you know, the creative process, and how things get made and how difficult it can be to get things made, you appreciate, I think, more the level of craft that comes out in a movie like this, where you look at things and go, wow, there was no part of that movie in what remained of the final edit that you could have further edited out. There was nothing there that you could have taken out and the movie would still have made sense.
And the things that I didn't notice until like second or third or, oh God, I don't know how many times I've watched this movie now. It's probably like over a dozen, because it's one of those movies that, like, well, back before I had kids, when it would, you know, I'd be home alone by myself if my, you know, husband was on business or, you know, just out for the evening or whatever, it would be me sitting, you know, with the week's mail sort of piled up on the coffee table and some, you know, catalogs and a glass of wine, just sort of with Constantine on in the background, just sort of paging through things, because that was exactly sort of the kind of movie that I could put on. And, you know, once I knew it, sort of half pay attention to it, look at, you know, that it is such a, the visuals are so nice. I could just sort of like walk through and look at the screen and go, oh yeah, that's a great part. And then go back again. But, you know, I never, and there were a few things that, you know, would bug me every once in a while when I would say to my, and, but it was more in that sort of, oh, Constantine, you're so silly with the, you know, the talking to the movie, like, why do you live in a bowling alley? What is with the hole? And Beeman apparently lives in the bowling alley too. The bowling alley, no one bowls in the alley. I don't know why.
It's just full of wizards and warlocks.
and a bunch of bottles hanging from the ceiling above Beeman that look gorgeous, but who knows why they're there. And I don't know why there's, it looked like there was about 8 months worth of water stored up in Constantine's apartment in big jugs for some reason. Like, that's where the bowling alley stores their, like, drinking water for the water cooler. I don't know why.
Maybe he's getting it all blessed.
Probably. It may, you know, I sort of wonder now, looking at, hearing about the stuff that ended up on the floor, it's like all these little things that were just sort of like, why is that? Like, the fact that at the end, they go to confront Balthazar. It's like they drive up to this random office building and go up. It looks like it's like 3 a.m, and he is standing there looking into a mirror in a conference room. And they just sort of burst in and defeat him. It's like, okay, does Balthazar just make a habit of standing in a specific conference room at 3 a.m. in an office building that we've never seen before, that, you know, he just sort of, that Constantine just sort of knows to go to, and that's where he's going to be? You know, so stuff like that. It's like, okay, there are parts where the lines are just not connected. You know, it's like you see the fat's been cut out, but some essential piece of information has just been missing. But there's other parts where you see the work that was, like you say, done and done very well. When they come out of the church, you know, they've had they've each had their audiences with the people they were there to see, you know, that their second sort of chance meeting of the day. And Chaz gets out of the cab as John walks away.
At least it's nice out. You always had a rotten sense of humor. And his punchlines are killers.
John! Constantine, it's raining! John! Hey!
And that's how she knows, because she's standing there, and that's how when Aunt, Isabel on the tape whispers his name, she knows to go back to him. She knows that that's a sign. She knows that that sign. She knows who her sister means. So it's like the deliberate, very paced, you know, feeding the audience little bits of information exactly when they need it. The movie does a pretty good job. And that's not easy. That's really difficult, actually. And I know that, you know, like you said, it's one of those things that no one notices it until it isn't there. And then it's like, right. Why didn't they? And it's like, well, because that's really hard to do, actually. And people don't always get it right.
Speaking of their meetings with their respective rendezvouses, uh-huh, in the church, Tilda Swinton.
Oh, Tilda Swinton.
Isn't she just perfect casting as an angel?
Tilda has been sent from another plane to better us as humans, I think, just by the fact of her presence on Earth.
Tilda Swinton and Cate Blanchett, they were basically both born to play angels, weren't
yes,
they?
Yes, yes. And Tilda is in, it's sort of amazing to me that she is in only two real scenes in this movie.
But she steals them both.
But exactly, she steals them both. And she, that conversation that she has, that Gabriel and John have, that to me encapsulates one of the things that I really like about this movie that I wish they had done a little more of.
Why haven't I served him enough? What does he want from me?
Only the usual. Self-sacrifice. Belief.
I believe, for Christ's sake.
No, you know. And there's a difference.
As much flack as sort of the good versus evil shoot 'em ups get for, you know, being, you know, good versus evil shoot 'em ups, a sort of hook onto religion as sort of a, you know, vehicle driver or whatever, none of them really discuss theology. And this is the big difference. This is, you know, the idea that because he has seen all of these things, he knows them for a fact. It'd be like saying, I believe in my toaster, you know, that it's a fact of life. It is there. It's not something that he has to actually put his heart and his faith into. And, you know, setting aside this whole idea of God and the devil being, you know, basically sitting there at a, you know, making this bet over all of humanity, which it's certainly not my favorite view of religion and Christianity, and I think it's rather cynical and very, you know, I think modern when modern pieces of culture, you know, adopt that, they really divorce it from its underpinnings, and you know
Well, remember, for the first 15 years or so of his existence, John Constantine was written exclusively by British and European writers. Uh-huh. And I think that makes a big difference in that respect, because while I don't think that aspect was directly in the comic,
uh-huh,
that attitude towards faith, religion, the notion of God and the pantheon, etc., was absolutely a part of the original comics and isn't, frankly, not that unusual in British and European works of fiction, even comic books.
You mean like the idea of
the idea of an uncaring God,
right?
A nihilistic attitude,
right?
That God. I mean, there's one line in the movie where,
I guess God has a plan for all of us.
God's a kid with an ant farm, lady. He's not planning anything.
Now that's a very European attitude towards God. And I will note that Francis Lawrence, the director, is German or Austrian. Sorry.
Oh, interesting. Okay, interesting. Yeah. And I saw that. I looked him up on the internet, and instantly I was like, "Oh, lots of music videos. That makes sense."
Yeah.
You know, not in the, you know, loud and incoherent and messy, because that's what this movie gets called, and it absolutely isn't. But the like focus on style and placement and visual that really and you know, it's a little slick at times, it feels a little slick, but always with a purpose. That's the difference. Is
ironically, the tone, the slickness of it and the tone of this actually strikes me as quite similar to the modern crop of Marvel movies.
Oh, yeah, exactly.
But of course, this came out before the first Iron Man movie, which really set that template and that tone and ushered in the era of the modern superhero movie.
Right.
And that sort of slightly playful tone, we're not embarrassed to be about comic books, we're just going to make a good movie, we happen to be based on comics, we don't really care. And that's kind of, I mean, obviously the tone is very different in many ways, but the attitude towards the source material actually struck me as quite similar in this. And I wonder if it had been released later, you know, if this had been released in 2010 instead of 2005,
mm-hmm,
would the reception as a result have been different? You know, if this was seen in a post-Iron Man context, would people have been more willing to go with it? I don't know.
When was the first of the Christian Bale Batman movies?
Oh, Batman Begins.
Yeah, that was around then, wasn't it?
2005. It was the
same year. That's fascinating.
But again, very different in tone to this.
Oh, very. But interest. I feel like they're almost sort of in the continuum. Constantine would sort of fall between them.
Right. Not quite as relentlessly grim as the Nolan Batman movies, but not as playful as the Iron Man movie.
Totally.
Yeah.
Exactly. But there is some playfulness to this movie. It has a sense of humor about itself. There's the scene where he's about to do the walking through to hell in Angie's apartment, and he's sitting there in the middle of the room with his pants rolled up, with his feet in a pan of water, and he's holding a cat in his lap, and he tells her to leave the apartment, and she leaves, and you know, she's making all these sort of, you know, because she's still the skeptic about this, and you always have to convince the skeptic in these movies and shows, so she's like, I can't believe this is what we're doing, and he's just, you know, like, you know, he basically, again, with the sort of gearing up to do the thing that he hates, and so she, like, walks out of the apartment, and she turns, and there's this long shot looking back at him as he's sitting there with the cat, in the looking sort of lost, this weird, you know, like, why is he sitting there in the apartment with the cat, and when his feet are in water, and the cat goes, rawr, and it's just this perfect sort of little, you know, it's a smile moment about, yeah, this looks ridiculous. He's about to do this thing that looks ridiculous. But then he does it, and it's a little heartbreaking. And the vision of hell that the filmmaker sort of adopted for this movie is really affecting. The sort of post-apocalyptic landscape that looks like, you know, L.A. after, you know, after all the bombs hit or whatever. And there's that sense that you are always located in hell wherever you were, sort of when you crossed over, that, you know, if you're in an apartment, when you cross over, you're in that same apartment in hell, except now it's bombed out and you can, you know, walk through the walls basically because there's nothing there. But there's this like nuclear wind sort of constantly blowing all of this debris off of cars and off of buildings and whatever.
And there's a firestorm raging continually throughout it. They actually, apparently, I read after I'd watched the movie, I went and looked at some of the reviews and criticisms of it, and they got a lot of flack for that vision of hell.
Why?
And I don't really know what, but because they said it was dull or unimaginative. And I'm like, no, actually, it was really imaginative.
Yeah.
It was really, I've never seen a depiction of hell like that in any other fiction, but, you know, movies, novels, comics, whatever. I've never seen it anywhere else. It was really good, I thought.
The thing that it reminded me of, like, from, I think, the beginning, was the sequence in Terminator 2 where Sarah Connor is having her nightmare about the coming apocalypse. And that sequence gave me nightmares when I saw it.
Oh, yeah. That's one of the most affecting nuclear holocaust depictions in cinema history.
Yes. And so, you know, it's sort of... it's interesting that they said that, you know, it wasn't inventive, it was, you know, sort of boring or dull. Because there's a number of things that people have said about this movie, or that the filmmakers themselves, I think, said later about this movie, that point to me towards us, like, the things that people think they want in a movie, they really don't. You know,
yes.
You think you want, like, something that's original and has, you know, we want, like, a really kinetic, crazy hell where everyone's getting everything and thing torn off them or whatever. And there was an interview that I read. I think this is when they were gearing up to start to do the Constantine TV series, which we haven't mentioned yet, which I haven't seen a single episode of. And I've heard recently has not been renewed for a second season, which is probably, I'm sure, is a shame in some respects. I have no idea what the reception of it has been or whatever, but the filmmakers said that one thing that they felt hampered by was the PG-13 rating on this movie. That if they could have done an R rating, they really could have done, you know, the grit and the awfulness and you know, having demons, you know, the messiness of it. And I'm like, thank God they did not get that R rating, because it was just the perfect amount of restraint. That was that they couldn't, you know, sort of lose themselves in ichor or, you know, just the gore of it. It didn't turn into...
I'm surprised it was a PG-13,
yeah.
given some of the scenes. I actually, because I didn't check the rating, I must admit, I just assumed that it was an R.
I'm pretty sure, well, there is the F word they say once. And there's a number of swears, but there's no nudity. I mean, talk about our screwed up rating system that then,
yeah.
you know, you can have like hellish nuclear, you know, visions, but oh, God forbid you see a boob. And I feel it's sort of like how the other, you know, Mad Men, to make a completely bonkers sort of parallel, that, you know, they can't show nudity on Mad Men, or they couldn't, you know, they had to allude to things that always added this very 50s and 60s feel of restraint, that, you know, this was a different age. And so I feel like I'm really glad that it would have turned into, you know, just exploding
it
demons.
It would have been Hellraiser.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Hellraiser. It would have been, oh God, you know what this movie got compared to? A.O. Scott complete, well, Roger Ebert, this made it into Roger Ebert's top list of most hated movies, which I'm like, really? You've seen a lot of movies.
Yeah. That was my first thought. I was like, really?
You know, dude. But A.O. Scott completely panned this in the New York Times, said that he felt they had gone, that they had dared themselves and almost won to make a movie more stupid than Van Helsing. And
wow,
the top of my head nearly blew off when I read that last night. Ebert's review wasn't even a review. It was like he was doing a stand-up routine about, you know, sort of riffing on, you know, oh, those Catholics and those, you know, it was like it didn't even take the movie on any sort of level that the movie, you know, deserved to be taken on.
You're talking about studio, the thought that there may have been sort of studio interference with the rating, the very end. The voiceover at the very end.
Oh, God, why? Why?
Yeah, just completely spoils the end. The end of any story is so important. It leaves such an impression. People will forgive a lot of problems if you can stick that landing and leave them with a really good ending.
Why?
And they had a really good ending, and then you've got a picture, some executive somewhere going, I don't understand. No, still not making sense. You put in a voiceover so that he can explain what just happened.
But it doesn't. It doesn't explain. It just says everything that the movie has said.
Has just said for the last 90 minutes, yeah.
It adds absolutely no information. It's what you said about how every piece of this movie is necessary up until that. It's true.
Apart
up until
from that
ending.
Yeah.
And what is wrong with just the slow pan over the roof and then watching him stick the gum in his mouth? What is wrong with that?
Yeah, that would have said everything that you need to say.
Exactly.
It's terrible. And just before then, we'd had a bit where, you know, I mean, the climax, we haven't really talked about the climax, but it's a really, again, this talks to it being like the essence of the comics. The climax, he essentially cons Lucifer and gives him the finger.
Yeah.
Literally. That is Constantine to a T. That is exactly the attitude of the comic character.
And my understanding is that the flipping him the bird is taken directly from the Garth Ennis, from the climax of the Garth Ennis run where he does the, that they lifted it from. And it's just perfect. And that whole, Peter Stamari. Oh,
isn't he good?
He is amazing.
I had no idea he was in this. And then when he turned up as Lucifer, I was like, oh, perfect.
Yes, yes. And that whole sequence at the end is just perfect. That the hospital. I don't know why there's all those people standing there. They need the holy water on them, you know, whatever. If, you know, I got the feeling that was one of the things that ended up on the cutting room floor was because the succubus that he's like dating or whatever is part of it. I get the feeling there's some essential piece of information in what ended up on the floor that would explain exactly what is going on
right,
there.
Yeah.
But the sequence in the pool where they're doing the exorcism, trying to get Mammon out of Angie, and then we get Chaz's big moment with him sort of stepping in and helping with this exorcism, and there's the shot of like the two of them just sort of leaning in and chanting over her, and it's every time I see the movie I just get so caught up and I'm like, yeah, you guys go, and I'm always so upset that Chaz is, you know, knowing that Chaz is about to, you know, get killed, and it's And then with the tattoos, which you've seen through, you've seen them through the movie. He's rolled up his sleeves a couple times. They're never explained, and it's perfect. You know, she never says, "What are those tattoos?" And he never says, "You know, well, that's for blah blah blah," and you know, calling down whatever, you know, or making some cryptic remark. It's like, no, of course he's got these tattoos, and that's what they do because this is who he is. And then when she drops out of the sky in that outfit, and it's like the entire, if nothing else about this movie was any good, Tilda Swinton dropping down on Keanu Reeves' chest wearing that outfit would be enough to justify its existence. It's just so, just, oh, I don't know who did the costumes or, you know, whatever, but good. They earned their pay that day when they put Tilda Swinton in that. It's just beautiful, and she's beautiful. And
once again, she steals the scene totally. She is so good in that scene.
Her acting is just on a different level. Now, not just a different level, like it's coming from a different universe from everyone else in this movie. And I think generally in most movies that she's in. And she has these lines.
You're handed this precious gift, right? Each one of you granted redemption from the Creator. Murderers, rapists, and molesters. All of you, you just have to repent. And God takes you into his bosom. In all the worlds, in all the universe, no other creature can make such a boast, save man.
And it just feels perfect coming out of her mouth, because she is supposed to be Gabriel. She's the one who, you know, she's got the, you know, the authority and apparently the insanity to say, although they're like, Gabriel, you're insane. It's like, oh, please, you know.
Right, but like, she plays it like a psychopath, which is why it's so effective.
Yes. And just, oh, that whole sequence.
One of the things they definitely got right, talking about ego, is, I mean, they got Constantine's utter contempt for the supernatural,
which is
a very big part of the comic. And that really comes across, this sort of blasé attitude to demons and hell. And again, fatalism, very, very nihilistic. But combined with narcissism and ego.
Yeah.
And you can feel that bubbling under the character. And again, that is a subtle but very important part of the original character. And that's another part where I think they absolutely nailed it.
Yeah. There's one of the, at the beginning of the movie, the first interaction between his character and Rachel Weisz, when she's like running for the elevator, and she, you know, hold the elevator. She says, and he's in the elevator, and she says, going down, and he says, not if I can help it, and just basically lets the door close. And
yeah.
It's the perfect combination of feeling sorry for himself and, you know, being a bit of a, you know, jerk.
Still giving the finger to the world.
Finger to the world. But you have to admit, he's under a bit of a burden. and so, you know, it's maybe not justified, but you can understand it. And when she comes to him later and, you know, asks him for help, and he, you know, says, can you point me in the right direction? And he says, sure, and points out of his apartment. And the only reason that he goes back after her is because he realizes that she's being chased by these you know, half-breeds, or, you know, things that shouldn't exist on our planet or whatever. He's a character in need of redemption. And you know, he still is at the end, even if, you know, it's been, maybe he's gotten a little bit of it. Satan's whole thing about saving him and taking those, you know, golf ball sized tumors out of his lungs is that Satan truly believes that Constantine is just going to damn himself again in some way or other, that he's going to, this is not a hard bet to take.
I think you get that from Peter Stormare's performance as well. That last look is a kind of, well, maybe not this time, but you know, next time.
Yes, yes, exactly. And although, okay, so those, how was he running through those apartment buildings? You know, he's chasing Angie's being pulled backwards through the office building and he's running. It's like, okay, half of your lungs are tumor at this point. How are you exactly doing this? So yeah, I mean, one of those, you know, little things that you do have to ding the movie for a little, but oh well.
But overall, I think, yeah, this is definitely an unjustly maligned movie, and one that anybody with a liking of the comic book, maybe perhaps not a sort of devout religious following of it, but somebody who enjoyed the book, mm-hmm. should read. Because I think you're right. I think it does require a little foreknowledge of the character to fill in some of those blanks.
Mm-hmm.
But if you have that, and as long as you don't mind changes being made for the sake of adapting it into a movie, then I think it really works.
Yeah, it does. And I sort of want to find who it is who thinks these are like, this is the worst movie, you know, sort of the to hold up and say, you know, it's not Constantine, or, you know, or it's almost as bad as Constantine, and say, okay, have you seen some of the movies that my husband has made me watch? And if not, can I make you see some of these movies? And then you can come back and watch Constantine, and at least, you know, that the movie, you can, maybe you'll at least have a little more respect for it, but
get some perspective. Get
exactly. Some definite perspective is needed here.
All right. And on that note, let's draw this to a close. Helene, thank you very much for being on the show. Where can people find you if they like what you have to say?
Well, people can find me on Twitter at Helene Wecker. If you're interested in my book specifically, that would be HeleneWecker.com. It has more information about it. And it's Helen with an extra E, like H-E-L-E-N-E. Or on Facebook, Facebook.com/WeckerHelene, just the two names reversed. I'm on sort of sporadically. I try to have at least one social media presence per day. I'm hoping that now that my kids are getting a little older, and I can sort of ramp back up and have more of a, you know, get a blog going again, or I kind of want to do a newsletter. I think that would be fun.
Not too much of the newsletter, because we all know that newsletters really just procrastination for not writing a novel.
I know.
Thanks for listening to Unjustly Maligned. I hope you enjoyed it, and if you did, please check out my comics, books, and music. Go to anthonyjohnston.com, where you'll find information and links to all of my work. Please also consider rating Unjustly Maligned on iTunes. It's the best way to spread the word about the show, and is very much appreciated. Unjustly Maligned is a 7RQ production for The Incomparable, and is made in England. You can find more information, links, and show notes at ump.fm. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time. Quick real-time follow-up, 2011 was when the new 52 launched.
So
I figure the original Hellblazer comic must have stopped, if not then, maybe 2010,
okay,
somewhere around then. I knew it was going throughout the 2000s, because, as I say, I know a few of the people who wrote it.
Oh, did I say 2003?
You did,
I meant 2013. Okay.
Ah, right, no,
okay.
It was before 2013.
Yeah, okay. Nicola Griffith was doing a lot of that too when she was doing Hild, and I think she's still doing it now that she's got she's writing the sequel to Hild too. Not Hild 2, the Hildening or something. Hild as well. The sequel. The sequel.
This time it's Hilda. Nobody ever complains that Sean Connery only does one character. You know what I mean? It's like Sean Connery has based his entire career on, mm-hmm, playing Sean Connery,
yes,
on camera.
Yes.
no matter what the role. I mean, famously, in The Hunt for Red October, he didn't even attempt a Russian accent. He just, you know, we have this Scottish-Russian submarine commander. And nobody cares.
No one cares.
Because he's so good and he's so charismatic. And I feel the same way about Keanu, honestly. I don't care that he plays, you know, or sort of vocally anyway, mm-hmm. sounds like the same guy in mm-hmm. every movie. Mm-hmm. Because he is charismatic and it's good.
Oh, like I said, he is just gorgeous to watch, that man. His entire body is just there. And there's this one scene where he's just sitting sort of hunched over after he sees the x-rays. And everything about him just is, he's just this physical picture of misery. I don't know if this is one of these things where it's like your friend who you just absolutely love, but they talk about two levels too loud for what you want. And so, you know, it's like one of those things that it's like a tick about the person that irritates you personally. And so I don't know if that's what it is that I have about Keanu Reeves, because I agree completely with you. I love, there are actors who basically play the same person their entire career, and I don't care, because I like that person. I love watching that person go, and so I will watch whatever movie that person is in.
The size of Keanu's hands.
What? I haven't noticed. Really?
Right. In that, but yeah, when, you know, when he's holding her down. Is it that? Is it when he's holding her down? It's after they've exercised her. After they've exercised her,
uh-huh.
and she's got, but then she's got the thing in her, the demon in her midriff,
uh-huh.
trying to come out, and he places his hand on her midriff uh-huh. to continue the exorcism. I mean, I know Keanu's quite tall,
uh-huh.
and Rachel Weisz is tiny,
uh-huh.
but the span of his hand almost completely covers the width of her stomach. It's insane.
Oh, I'm going to have to go back and look. That's funny.
It's amazing. It's like, the stereotypical Mills and Boone, you know, like hero who can span the heroine's waist with his hands. He probably could do that.
Oh, that's funny. I never noticed. I never noticed that.
Like, in fact, the Doctor Who episode that you mentioned, uh-huh. The aside from Al about the Cyberman who got lost in the TARDIS.
I think I actually, like, a number of years ago read a piece of fanfic about that Cyberman, what he's, like,
really?
Doing in the TARDIS. It like, rang a bell as he was talking about it. Yeah.
Oh, that's fantastic. I must tell him about that. She is, of course, Ms. Helen Wecker. Helen, welcome to the show.
Hi, it's actually Helene, but thank you very much.
Oh,
I'm so glad to be here.